on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
You have the idea of the sons of God, i.e. the Watcher Angels. You have the sons of God admiring the women. But the end result of that is, the translation is men of renown, giant figures, which suggests the idea of the Greek heroes, that they had divine origin and became great figures. This is all very obscure. There are references in some of the prophets to these men of renown, but that's definitely a softer version than the first Enoch, which is quite clear that these watchers introduce evil to the world. So it's the original sin is spiritual, not human made. That's a critical line is when one of their leaders, Azazel, he says, to him ascribe all sin. Now, that's an extraordinary statement. I mean, on that basis, it wasn't even Cain's sinful hatred of his brother's favor from God that causes anything, or even Adam's temptation or succumbing to temptation or ease. It's actually Azazel who really screws it up. He's the one who teaches mankind how to make breastplates, weapons of war, cosmetics, metallurgy, including what we call now alchemy, all the arts of deception, everything that tries to make one thing look more than it is, everything associated with female vanity, everything associated with male vanity, male domination. So they teach poison making, war, how to manifest your hatred of your fellow human in the most violent way. All of this knowledge was heavenly knowledge, known in heaven, but kept from human beings until these watchers corrupted.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I welcome back Tobias Churton to discuss his latest book, The Books of Enoch Revealed. Tobias elaborates on the significance and content of the Books of Enoch, clarifying their origins, thematic elements, and historical context. He explores the apocalyptic and messianic themes within these texts, and also delves into the idea of fallen angels introducing evil into the world, a concept later influencing Gnostic beliefs. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Tobias Churton is an authority on Gnosticism, Hermeticism, Freemasonry, and Rosicrucianism. Appointed Honorary Fellow of Exeter University in 2005 to specialize in Western esotericism, he is the author of many books, including The Lost Pillars of Enoch, The First Alchemists, and Gnostic Philosophy, as well as acclaimed biographies of Elias Ashmole, William Blake, Aleister Crowley, and G.I. Gurdjieff. He joins me today to discuss his latest publication, The Books of Enoch Revealed. Tobias, welcome back to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Delighted.
Yes. Well, I am very excited to speak with you today about your latest book, The Books of Enoch Revealed. And one of the reasons is that I've been teaching Western religious history for about 20 years, and increasingly students have been expressing an interest in covering the Books of Enoch. I remember one day I came to class and a student had a copy of it on the very first day of class and was very disappointed that we weren't going to go in depth in any kind of way imaginable in a survey course with the Books of Enoch. And what I told the student at the time was, yeah, we don't really cover that because it's just, you know, pseudepigrapha. It's apocryphal, right? And I thought that maybe this might be the place to begin. I'm guessing that the people who are going to watch or listen to this probably have a passing understanding of the Books of Enoch. But I thought that maybe you could say a few words about, or maybe more than a few words, about what they are. What are the Books of Enoch? Because I think a lot of people think there's just the one Book of Enoch, but there's not, correct?
Yeah, we refer to First Enoch, Second Enoch, and Third Enoch. The confusion is partly because First Enoch, usually known as the Book of Enoch, is itself a collection of books in the old sense of the book, i.e. a piece of writing. So that also, you can refer to the Book of Enoch as the Books of Enoch as well, because they come together from different dates. The other problem is that there's a suggestion that they're actually a series, which is not the case. They're not necessarily directly related to each other. Second Enoch, First Enoch, the oldest parts of it are thought to have been written possibly as early as the 3rd century BCE, if you use BCE or BC. But the majority of the text is mid-second century BCE, thereabouts, and the latest parts of the Book of Enoch would be in the early 1st century BCE. Now, Second Enoch, which takes the story to a slightly different level and gives us a plan of the 10 heavens, Second Enoch is now dated by scholars on internal evidence and comparative studies as being sort of late Herodian period, which is before around the time, shortly before Jesus's birth, which I date about 7 BCE. But it could be a little older, but it could also be in the early years of the 1st century BCE. Now, sorry, the 1st century AD, or Common Era, if you prefer. This makes Second Enoch in particular a hot book in the formation of the Christian doctrine, although I would say also the books of Enoch in First Enoch are critical texts in the proto, what would become a proto-Jesus movement. Now, Third Enoch was only discovered relatively recently, and it's in the Bodleian Library in a 17th century text, and this is quite different to the other two texts insofar as it's clearly in the class of Hekhalot and Merkava Jewish mysticism, and it belongs really in that particular field. But as for dating, very, very hard. The dating range for Third Enoch is somewhere between maybe 500 and 1000 Common Era AD. So that's a very different kind of text. But it is significant, particularly because we have the identification of Enoch with the figure Metatron.
Right. Yeah. And I want to ask about Metatron,
Is
but
now the
first,
time? We haven't really introduced much.
no. Yeah. And that's what I was going to say, but that's going to have to wait a little bit. So, kind of focusing on one Enoch book, the first book of Enoch. The story is, I guess the question, who was Enoch? Enoch is mentioned in Genesis, I think it's 5:6. He is what, Noah's grandfather, I think. And it has this.
He's seventh in line from Adam.
Okay.
That's the really critical
Okay.
thing. He's seventh in line from Adam in the line of Seth,
Okay.
which was Adam's third son after the debacle of Cain and Abel. So you
Right.
then have a third son, Seth, who's really the righteous one and sets up a kind of righteous line. Enoch's appearance is particularly interesting because whereas all these other patriarchs mentioned have extraordinarily long lifespans, as we would say it, Enoch's is there he is at 365 years, which puts him in the field of solar symbolism and a solar calendar, which is also significant, becomes significant more the more you know about the books. But it's the write-up on him is very interesting. It's clearly edited. It's been edited down, but the statement is Enoch walked with God and God took him. God took him. Right. Well, that's what does it mean? God took him. Well, that he walked with God means that he was in perfect consistency with God's righteousness and was favored. God took him was taken to mean as early as we know in the period of Genesis's currency as meaning that he was taken bodily to heaven without dying. So he didn't die. He was so righteous, he didn't suffer death. And he therefore becomes a kind of emissary from heaven in the Enochic, specifically Enochic books. We don't get any of that in the book of Genesis. If it was ever there, it's been edited out, or it may be another tradition altogether. But he's in there with that. These are very telling points. We can't say that the Enochic books, First Enoch, the books of First Enoch particularly, are derived from Genesis or you know, even commentaries on Genesis. I don't get that feeling. If you read the text, the impression is that it's an independent tradition about Enoch, perhaps an independent tradition that Genesis itself was using in a highly redacted form.
Okay. Well, and Genesis itself is a compilation of various texts. That's at least the assumption by
Yeah,
most
you've
modern
got mainly
scholars.
the big two is the priestly tradition and the Yahwist tradition, which is loosely based on whether God was referred to as Yahweh or whether he was referred to as El Elyon,
Right.
with the basic Semitic word El being used for God.
Right.
That's
And
the but they, if you read, say, John Day's super commentaries on Genesis, it's quite interesting. Different emphases come in, and the errors that the copyists make when they're trying to get the two traditions and possibly others to fit. This is all anathema, of course, to evangelicals who would have
Oh,
it
yeah.
that Moses wrote it in a fit of total automatic writing from the Lord himself. All I could say is that if the Lord wrote it personally, then he has a very busy editing tool going on in his infinite intelligence.
Yeah, and there are some inconsistencies there too, so
Of
that they don't
course.
want to address. So Enoch is, you know, so Genesis, the understanding was that it was always kind of put together during the Babylonian exile. And, you know, we don't need to get into any kind of debates about that, but
Right.
it's,
Keep it
we
to
know
Enoch.
that. Yeah. So we know that when they came back from the exile, at least Ezra has a copy of we assume the Torah. And Enoch then is a little bit post that, but fairly around the same time, right? So there was this kind of, I don't know if the wording here is correct, a kind of ban on prophecy. And this is when these, what are called the pseudepigraphic texts, started to appear, because people didn't stop writing these texts. Now, it was suggested in the book that Enoch may actually represent, and I hope I'm not jumping up too far here, but it may represent its own sort of strain of Judaism. And would that be a strain of Judaism that then begins during this post-exilic period? I know that the history is, you know, pretty intense, and I don't want to get too lost in the weeds, but I was hoping that maybe you could address its place within the Jewish tradition at around the time it's writing and leading up to the period of Jesus.
Yeah, well, this is, as you suggest, is a tangled issue, because so much of it is based on probabilities, possibilities, but very few certainties. Nevertheless, scholarship strives to clarify, as the generations go by, the field. And I think what we can say at this point in time is that the Enochic tradition, which is the way scholars of Enoch refer to the literary traditions that involve Enoch, is, as you suggest there, it's a particular strand and may represent a particular party or group or associations of Jews from about the time of the defeat of the Ptolemaic domination of Israel. The Ptolemaic, I hope listeners may know that after the death of Alexander the Great, his generals took over his empire and intermarried with existing aristocratic families. The Ptolemies, which were of Greek origin, intermarried with the Egyptians and produced the Ptolemaic dynasty. They are dominating Israel up until about 197 BCE, when they are defeated by the Seleucids, who are also descended from one of Alexander's generals, General Seleucus, and they're running Syria and parts of Greece. And the Seleucids have a party of support in Jerusalem, and the Ptolemies have a party of support, because you can imagine the Jews who've returned have to constantly have to play a political gamble diplomacy game of whose side do they need to be on this year, depending on who's dominant. You see that in international politics all the time. So you've got a division within the priesthood in Jerusalem in this period, 2nd century BC, which eventually erupts in famous events that everyone knows about. Judas Maccabeus is so outraged by the activities of the Seleucid the fourth Epiphanes, who bans Judaism, forces priests to eat pork, and persecutes and murders the priesthood, members of the priesthood. And you get a war of liberation fought by Judas the Hammer and the eventual establishment of a Hasmonean dynasty. This is the kind of period where the Enochic books are being generated. Now, what do they address that's specific in that era is that the Jewish people have, far from the return after the Edict of Cyrus of 538 BCE, far from it leading to a glorious return to Jerusalem and a fantastic new temple and a blessing of God and all the things the prophets Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel were interpreted to suggest, that there would be a great reward after the punishment of the exile as they saw it. This hadn't happened. They were languishing under satraps, Persians, then Greeks, Hellenistic influenced people, and they were struggling to survive with a great deal of corruption. And in that period, there is this intense questioning, really based on the question of Abraham asks in Genesis, shall not the Lord of earth do aright? If God is just, if God is proper, righteous, as the prophets insisted, and if the Jews are trying to follow the prophetic tradition of righteousness or traditions of righteousness, why is it that misery carries on? Why are the Jews still being subjected to persecution and violence and theft and rapacious inroads into their livelihoods? And you get a development that people will be familiar with of what we call apocalyptic literature. And apocalyptic means to bring out of hiding. And what's being brought out of hiding in this period is the idea that, aha, don't rush to too many conclusions. Everything that's going on, including all the historical stuff that's happening now, is all part of God's plan and has been so from the beginning. Indeed, in the first book of Enoch, Enoch comes to tell his son Methuselah, famous for his longevity, to tell him that future generations need to know that all sorts of things are going to happen, but in the end, the righteousness of God will be established and the wicked will be punished, and there will be a new heaven, a new earth, and all those who we saved will be living in a paradise. Now, we're of course familiar with this, because this is, in fact, is the core message of a great deal of what passes for Christianity and has done for many, many, many generations. The apocalyptic wing of Christianity has never died out at all, and as Johann Valentin Andrei wrote in about 1620, he said the apocalyptic type of idea tends to come out when the church is slowing down in its true business, which is an interesting aside from that period during the 30 Years' War. What we're getting an Enoch who is an emissary from the all, who has all knowledge. He has been to heaven, he's been shown its works. He's been shown the entire processes of history. He's shown how the universe operates, and he is therefore an authority. He walks with God. God took him, and in the Enochic literature, God sends him back as an emissary to his son to predict what's going to happen. Now, it doesn't take much imagination when you read the prophecies in First Enoch, of specifically with regard to Jewish history, that you can trace our familiar biblical tale, but also taking it up to this period where we're getting to the Hellenistic takeover of the culture of Israel. And in the later sections, you are getting the strong implications that we're into the Herodian period. Herod was made king by agreement of the Roman Senate. He was an Idumean Arab who converted to Judaism and said he was more Jewish, you know, more Jewish than the Jews, a claim later echoed rather by Paul, if I remember rightly, that it is excessive in righteousness. And of course, he rebuilds the temple. And that's the period in which Jesus is growing up, which is the erection of the new temple and so forth. So the Enochic books are addressing this period. Now, you said something earlier about that you were able to dismiss your pupils' interest by referring to the apocryphal or pseudepigraphic nature of the book. This has to be has been thoroughly challenged, and all the scholarship in the book reflects this, that this idea of apocryphal books and pseudepigrapha does not apply in any realistic sense whatsoever to the real times we're talking about. There was no Jewish canon.
Right.
There was no official Jewish Bible in the period we're talking about. Say we talk 200 to the time of Jesus, 200 BCE to the time of Jesus. There is no official group of books. So if a work appeared that gathered authority, that was regarded as sacred and regarded as a message from God, then it was accepted by those people as scripture. It was readable, and they didn't have to have it pass through a censor or an authority. Some people would like it, some would not. But we know that certain people were very fond of these Enochic traditions. And it is the contention of the best of scholarship today that without this Enochic tradition, your Jesus movement as we knew it or thought we knew it would hardly have occurred, would hardly have taken place. So the book, particularly the first Enoch, is a vital text for understanding the distinctiveness of the Jesus movement. This makes it of world historical significance. But ever since it was published in English in 1821, it has been, even on the title page of the first English translation, it is toning it down. It's described as an apocryphal work. Now, the word apocrypha originally meant a secret book. It then started to have the idea that it was works which were falsely attributed, i.e. that the author's name didn't justify it as sacred scripture. But nobody says the books of Enoch that we know of as apocryphal until at least the second century common era, Christian era, AD. We ought to settle it. Which one we're going to use?
We can use BCE very annoyed. And CE. Yeah, use BCE and CE.
Yeah, the trouble with them, those things, is that they're a bit of a modernism, and most believers are quite happy with BC and AD, Anno Domini. But of course, as scholars, you're supposed to not have any kind of political religious commitments. But they were a bit of a cheat. Actually, I mean, even Common Era is a literal translation of Aleister Crowley's view of Era Vulgari, which is the way he distinguished his time scale from the Christian one. So, but anyway, that aside, we know what we're talking about. First century AD, CE. All right.
Yeah, yeah. Use whichever one you're most comfortable
with.
Mustn't
offend the Muslims. That's right.
Yeah.
But where were we? So, yeah. Were they pseudepigraphical? Well, what isn't pseudepigraphical in the Old Testament, as Christians call it? You know, how many of the books of Isaiah were actually voiced by Isaiah? The books of Isaiah, the sections of Isaiah, Deutero-Isaiah, Trito-Isaiah, scholars talk about. You know, and was the book of Daniel the work of Daniel? I rather don't think so. And did Moses write the Pentateuch? I don't think they'll get many people seriously advocating that today, any more than whether Paul wrote every single letter attributed to them. So what you have is respectable scripture and, I suppose, unrespectable scripture. And some parties liked some scriptures and some parties liked other scriptures. We can talk later about, what happened later when Enoch falls out of the eventual Jewish canon, which starts to appear after AD 90 CE, 90 CE. Yeah, if you like. And we can certainly talk about how the Christian church, first of all, embraced First Enoch contents as we think they were at that time. That's a very critical issue. But what's really made the huge splash, the explosion in Enochic studies, is the discovery in the 50s among the caves at Qumran of fragments of seven, no less than seven texts of books of the contents of the books of Enoch, with one critical exception, which is that so far they haven't found the section which is known as the parables or similitudes of Enoch. And that's very important because that text is of enormous significance to Christian origins, I think. But there it is. So we find that whoever put the collections together and hid them in these caves at Qumran, they liked Enoch a lot, or at least at some period of the history. Now, Professor Gabriele Boccaccini at Syracuse University, he talks about Enochic Judaism as a specific kind of Judaism that has to be reckoned with. And he says he's written in his early books anyway, that they had a specific doctrine of evil that marks them completely out. And that doctrine of evil is the idea that evil was brought into the world, that creation is corrupted by rebel angels, the wicked watchers, who conspire to come to Earth on Mount Hermon because they're so swept up by erotic attraction to human women that they can't contain themselves in the presumably sexless court of heaven, the way they normally reside. And they've just got to have these women. And according to First Enoch, the Book of the Watchers particularly, this has appalling consequences of miscegenation. And a race of giant monsters is born, generally called the Nephilim. If that story was known to the compilers of Genesis, then they've kind of softened it because you have the idea of the sons of God, i.e. the watcher angels. You have the sons of God admiring the women, but the end result of that is the translation is men of renown, giant figures, which suggests the idea of the Greek heroes, that they had divine origin and became great figures. This is all very obscure. There are references in some of the prophets to these men of renown, but that's definitely a softer version than the first Enoch, which is quite clear that these watchers introduce evil to the world. So it's the original sin is spiritual, not human made. That's a critical line is when one of their leaders, Azazel, he says, "To him ascribe all sin." Now, that's an extraordinary statement. I mean, on that basis, it wasn't even Cain's sinful hatred of his brother's favor from God that causes anything, or even Adam's temptation or succumbing to temptation or Eve's. It's actually Azazel who really screws it up. He's the one who teaches mankind how to make breastplates, weapons of war, cosmetics, metallurgy, including what we call now alchemy. All the arts of deception, everything that tries to make one thing look more than it is, everything associated with female vanity, everything associated with male vanity, male domination. So they teach poison making, war, hate, how to manifest your hatred of your fellow human in the most violent way. All of this knowledge was heavenly knowledge, known in heaven, but kept from human beings until these watchers corrupt it. And this is very radical. Now, you have little references to this in the New Testament in various ways, but the most interesting and the most identifiable Enochic strain which is coming into Christian scripture is the demonic population. And the prince of this idea of the prince of this world and his legions. Where everyone remembers the story of Jesus casting out the legions of demons from the madman of Gadara. Now, all of this ties in very much with Enochic traditions, that when God first decides to destroy the power of the giants, he can't destroy them utterly because they're of heavenly origin, and therefore they have immortality. So you can destroy the body through, and in fact the story of the flood is brought in here really as the real cause of the flood was to wipe out these dreadful creatures, which are preying and eating human beings. And it is a cry from humanity to Raphael in heaven that finally reaches the ear of God. And God sends our friend Enoch down to declare to the watchers that their time is up and God intends to destroy them. And they, please, please, Enoch, don't do this. Don't let this happen to us. They don't have any power over Enoch. This is very interesting. By this time, he basically has archangelic power. And he's a cut above these watchers, and they daren't hurt him. He's from God direct. He's the real ambassador, and he knows what's going on. And now, in order to destroy these giants, they have to be the rebel angels themselves are enchained in places under the earth and put there waiting judgment. But the giants have their bodies are destroyed, but their souls have to be put in eternal fire. And this is where our familiar idea of the sinner in flames of eternal, you know, that never go out. The point is that they don't go out is because these are immortal creatures. They come from heaven, and therefore, in order to keep them controlled, if you think of that scene in The Terminator where finally he's extinguished, his light goes out when he goes into the cauldron. The problem with the watchers, the giants rather, the offspring of the watchers and human beings, is that the light doesn't go out. The light stays on, so they have to keep the cauldron going. Now, in Christian mythology and indeed preaching today, they will still talk about how poor sinners are going to spend eternity in hell in, you know, deeply hot. That, in fact, was a punishment that is only appropriate for these giants, and it gets carried on to include all sinners. And you can see, again, the actual construction of doctrines over time and the way they carry on. So you have, by the time of Jesus in the first century, you have a fully comprehensive notion that the world is haunted, as it were, by occasional presences of these demons. And now that wasn't a belief unique, of course, to Jewish people. This idea of invisible darknesses and demonic power, you'll find in Greek culture as well and in Egypt. And most religion was about trying to be protected, you know, from these presences which could erupt. And certain places, usually if they've got a hole in the ground or a chasm, and especially if there's some nice volcanic smoke coming out of there, are associated as particularly the home of these demons. But they've been put there for one reason. They're put there awaiting an absolute and final judgment, which in the first book of Enoch is pitched as being absolutely imminent. Any day now, heaven and earth are going to be remade as a new heaven and earth. And of course, we're then into the worldview of a great deal of the what we call the New Testament. But if you get into it, you realize, in fact, these are already existent Jewish ideas.
Right. Yeah, I always say that Christianity emerged out of actually this cauldron of many different influences, but from a
bit
Jewish...
general, I think, Nick, that
yeah.
Well, many influences.
I have specific ones. And from a Judaic perspective, there is this apocalyptic expectation, but also a messianic expectation.
Well, Enoch covers both, really.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask, because I can definitely see the apocalyptic, but I was curious about the messianic. because if I understand correctly, what we find in Enoch is this language of the Son of Man. Is that the trajectory for the messianic aspect?
I think this is the real, the absolute vital. If we're looking at Enochic literature in terms of its relevance to the origins of Christianity, the key factor that has to be faced is that anybody who has grown up in broadly Christian traditions will have heard in the New Testament at one point or another, or rather in the Gospels, this is where we get it, a reference to a figure called the Son of Man. And Jesus takes this for himself. Now, most people, you know, the Son of Man has nowhere to lay. The fox has his lair, you know, birds have their nest, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Even that idea is in the first book of Enoch, in fact. The idea of a power of God being lost in the world and not finding a proper home here, alienation. But most people would think the Son of Man, and many theologians have written, and I'm sure many theological students will have absorbed the notion that Son of Man is really just a kind of alternative phrase for Son of God. And that they're really, well, Son of Man is emphasizing his humanity, Son of God is emphasizing his divinity. And of course, you've had Jewish critics who've said, no, this is all a misunderstanding. The phrase, one like a Son of Man, appears in Ezekiel and in the book of Daniel, and it refers simply to a human being. It was a son of Adam, as the phrase is in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You know, it just means a human being. Well, Jesus is not talking about the Son of Man as a human being in general. He says it's Caesarea Philippi when and angers Peter to the extent that Peter attacks Jesus. And he says the Son of Man is going to be effectively killed. And that's part of his role. The Son of Man is going to be killed. Not sons of men, the Son of Man. Not only that, the Son of Man will come in Matthew. They're absolutely clear that the greatest use of the Son of Man is in Matthew's gospel. And he's going to come and judge the earth. He's the coming judge. So there's your Messiah. So Son of Man becomes then a name for an anointed or elected, the elected one, which is the actual phrase of Luke when Jesus is baptized, the elect one. This elect one will come and judge the earth, and that's the Son of Man. And we don't find the phrase Son of God in the Enochic writings, but in the last, the what we consider the latest part of the first Enoch, the similitudes, we have the only systematic usage of this phrase, Son of Man. Without this, we would be really lost as to why this phrase Son of Man exists in the Gospels at all. You'll notice it is not in Paul's letters. He does not use this phrase Son of Man. He talks about Jesus as a second Adam, never uses the phrase Son of Man. It's not a tradition that Paul is completely happy with, even though he says that women should cover their heads because of the angels. Do you know that line? He says, because of the angels. In other words, the angel, it's a slight implication that the angels might find them too fanciable, you know, even in the synagogue. So you've got to watch these angels, you know. They're sex-starved up there, apparently. That also has, I don't mean to be facetious, but just to make a point.
Yeah.
Now, this Son of Man in the parables of Enoch has a very specific role. He is literally the right hand being to God himself. He will come to judge. He is the one who will come to judge humankind and the entire creation and order it. He's called the Son of Man. It possibly is a development on the figure of called one like the Son of Man in Daniel. I don't see any problem with that general idea. If indeed Daniel is influential, as many people believe, many scholars suspect, on parts of the Enochic tradition. But as I say, the book of Daniel is really referring to an angelic figure who is like a man. Now, we've already had in the book in Ezekiel, which we can date to the 6th century BCE, we have in Ezekiel already the idea that the ultimate vision of God is one like a man, one like a son of man. In other words, God's actual image is human-like, and it is because of that that humans should be respected because we carry within us the image of God. You know, that's a famous phrase, man is made in the image of God, that is in Genesis, and it is quite literal. It is not, as many scholars have tried to evade the straightforward meaning of the Hebrew, man is made in the image of God means that man's basic appearance is akin to his ultimate father. And the Son of Man is, if you like, the reflection of the ultimate God, but he has a relationship with the world that's created. And one who has a vision of the glory, according to Gilles Quispel, a very good theologian, Dutch theologian who I met, he said basically the Son of Man is one who has seen intimately the glory. Now, in the end of the first Enoch, in Similitudes, Enoch becomes and is identified as the Son of Man. Isn't that amazing? And of course, in the New Testament, the identification, you can cross out Enoch and just put in Jesus, because Jesus is the Son of Man. Now, this brings us to a whole multidimensional view of Christian origins and Christology and the origins. It's very interesting if you look at Christology and the development of Christology in the early church, the patristic period, you know, up to about 500 AD from the origins of the Jesus movement, you will find very little interest in the Son of Man. It goes out. You won't find the Son of Man in the creeds. They're not arguing about the Son of Man. It's always about it's always about Son of God. That's what they're interested in. You know, the messianic claim that Jesus is God's son. But in fact, the solution, I would have said, was that if they had known more about the origin of the Son of Man, they might have come to a very different way of seeing the issue. But that's very much a personal view of mine. So if you want to know what, now, that does not mean, by the way, that Jesus just read First Enoch. My guess is he was brought up with it. I think it was in the atmosphere in which he was raised and in his education, because I think he's of that strand of a priestly line that is in conflict with the authoritative, the richest and the most powerful priests. I think Jesus is in the line of the priestly resistance, of which we know, even in Josephus, we know that priestly resistance carried on in Egypt, where there was, in fact, an alternative temple. I have a whole chapter on this. I didn't even know this place existed. It was not part of my theological education at Oxford or indeed anywhere else. And I've never met anybody else who knew that there was a Jewish temple founded by Onias III or Onias IV in this very period of when the Seleucids take over from the Ptolemaic dynasty. And there is a split within the Jerusalem priesthood. And Onias, whether third or fourth, I think is almost certainly Onias III, who I would identify as the righteous priest in some of the Qumra material, the teacher of righteousness. He goes to Egypt, and to the Ptolemies say, succumb to his argument that it will help the Ptolemaic cause in Egypt, which has suffered huge setbacks because of the Seleucids, if they allow a Jewish temple on the model of the Jerusalem temple to be built in the Heliopolitan Nome, which is just north of Cairo, on the road to Israel. Now, what happens when Joseph has his dream that he's got to take Jesus to safety? Where does he take him? Egypt. Doesn't say where, does it? Well, of course, it could have been Alexandria. There was a big Jewish community there and an integrated Jewish community. He might have gone to Alexandria. Just might have had something to do with this temple, which in fact stood and was functioning until the Romans destroy it just after the fall of Masada. 74, so we're talking 74 CE. So for 300 years, roughly, we have an alternative Jewish temple functioning in Egypt. Wow. This, not a synagogue, a temple with priests. We had found graves around it. There's all of this. One of the great delights of my book was to bring this to light, because I think it's significant. I suspect, only suspect, and a lot of scholars will say, you just haven't got enough evidence, and I agree. There's not enough evidence to draw a definite line between this institution, of which we know quite very little really, and the Enochic tradition. But I suspect it will become important in time. And it's certainly revealing about this battle that's going on constantly in Jerusalem in this period and goes right through the early life of Jesus and the expectations that the Sadducean party, which is basically pro-Herod, which is regarded as not truly righteous because of the behavior of the Herodian family primarily, who were outrageous by any standards of prophetic Judaism. This constant struggle within the priesthood, the poorer priests against the richer priests. Josephus refers to this. The richer priests were able to get mobs. They had more money. You have that emphasis in the acts that Paul is involved with in all this in some way. Perhaps he was originally a Herodian who goes over. Who's to know? We have all the evidence that Jesus's brother, who became leader of the church after Jesus and is then killed by the totally out of control Sanhedrin in 62 CE on the steps of the temple, Jesus' brother James, is murdered, that he is one of the poorer priests who wore his knees out, says Hegesippus, in his devotion to God. This is authentic Christian origin stuff. Had this been put in a integrated manner 150 years ago, if this had been all sorted out as it still needs to be, and I think my book is an attempt at this, the Hitler and his people could never have suggested there was a distinction between Judaism and Christ.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's an excellent point. We're starting to run out of time, so there's going to be a lot that we won't be able to get to today. But one immediate question I have for you in regards to that Jewish temple in Egypt, would that be then connected, or is there any evidence of connection with that to the Ethiopian church where that preserved the Book of Enoch as part of their canon?
No, I don't think there's certainly no evidence whatsoever, and certainly not even fragments to even draw even the most speculative conclusion. I'd say those are separate issues, certainly as things stand. But we must always remember that what we have of ancient history, while we paint lovely pictures and make movies, and if you painted a real picture of what we know, there'd be all holes everywhere. It'd be like the remains of Da Vinci's Last Supper before it was restored. That's our real image of us. Now, the Ethiopian Tewahedo Orthodox Church, this is important. Today, if you go there and you look at their Bible, you will find the Book of Enoch comfortably sitting next to the Book of Job as part of the Ethiopian canon. This may be inconvenient for Catholics, Orthodox, Protestants, etc., but they've had it there for very, very many years. They don't find any problem with it, except problems that are brought to them when they're accused by, you know, missionaries telling the Orthodox Tewahedo Church what they should believe in. Then they have to make a defense and that sort of thing. And of course, you will have members of the Ethiopian Church, I dare say, who are a bit skeptical about why it's there. But others, I hope that they happily keep it. We have the really bizarre situation that here we have the only prophecy quoted in the Bible that is not in the Bible. In the epistle of Jude, who I suspect may be Jesus' brother, Judas, given the title of the book, Judas, that Yuda in Hebrew, obviously. In the Jude's epistle, which has a very similar feel to it as the epistle of James, which also has been identified as Jesus' brother, I think the fact that Jude uses the Book of Enoch as a principal authority for declaring that the evil that Jesus' followers are suffering in his time is going to end soon. He quotes liberally from the Book of the Watchers. Now, That was enough for the most of the early patristics. Justin Martyr's happy with that. Tertullian, who's a difficult legalist, a difficult bugger, would say, quite difficult to please, and a real pain. He says, "I'm not arguing with the Epistle of Judas. If God wants if God wants that prophecy there, then I accept that the first Enoch is Christian literature. It's Christian literature. It's there. You can't deny it." And it's amazing to see how theologians ever since that time have tried to get round this. It's really quite laughable, the attempts that have been made to say, well, well, of course, anyone can quote from anything. It doesn't necessarily mean they support the whole thing. Oh, come off it. This is the only prophecy in the Bible, Hebrew, Christian, whatever, that is not there. The book's not there. Well, of course, we can then argue, well, how would it have been if it had been there? Well, go and ask the Ethiopians who've had it there at least we know for certain about 600 years at least. I presume, it was brought there in late Roman Empire period, because when we look at the textual tradition, we know there was a Greek Book of Enoch that was doing the rounds really as a kind of separate book and then sometimes combined with other books and found in Upper Egypt. Well, when there were missionaries going off to Ethiopia, I presume some of them took it with them, if indeed it wasn't already there. According to the Acts of the Apostles, Philip has the meeting with the Ethiopian, and some would say Ethiopia is the first ever Christian country. So, unless you want to simply discount that because it's in Africa and was knowledge of it was lost to Western Europe for 1,000 years, that it doesn't matter. Well, I'm afraid Enlightenment does matter, because James Bruce, the Scottish explorer, brought back his Book of Enoch in 1793, and 1794 brings it. He gives one copy to the Pope, who deposits it, and it's sort of forgotten. He gives one to the King of France, who gives it to his librarian, who scratches his head and realizes, oh shit, I don't mind my French. He says, I don't know how to get airs. Yes, of course, I do know something about these strange languages, but oh, damn it, I can't translate it. James Bruce, who had lived in Ethiopia, says, I can try. I'll do the translation. And he manages to stop the translation happening simply because he's not really up to it. He doesn't know enough of his. He had spoken knowledge of Ethiopian and some written, but he just didn't have enough. And it's not until, goodness me, nearly 50 years later, when it's translated by an Oxford professor of languages, and not a great translation, but a pretty good one. But of course, he releases it as a muted. Oh, don't worry, it's only a pseudepigraphical text, but very interesting, very interesting. Yeah, it's so we've seen a revolution taking place, and that is just going to get bigger now as. Of hard it may be for some to take it, but the penny's going to drop.
Like I
Or should I
said,
say drachma? Yeah.
as I said, there's a lot that is still undiscussed. I have questions about Gnosticism because the idea of the watchers
Yeah, I think
really.
it's the origin of the archons. But I mean, the very word archon, it's already there. It's in the book of Daniel. The archon is the ruler. The devil is that Satan is described as an archon in the New Testament. When Jesus has the vision of the fall of Satan, he says, now his reign is over. I can't remember the exact, it just escapes me at the moment. But the word is archon. And the archons are, without doubt, when you translate the watchers, you're going to be thinking in terms of the archons. But this is very important. How do you make the link between the watchers and the archons? Well, it was a Jewish tradition in the second, first, in immediate pre-Christian era, that each nation had its angel, or behind that it had tutelary angel, and these were associated with rebel angels because they did not encourage the worship of Yahweh, but of their own gods and so forth. So the world was already governed in Jesus' time by spiritual powers who controlled the nation. So there's in Daniel, there's one like the Son of Man goes off to see the Archon of Persia, and then he goes to see the Archon of Greece. So he's having a kind of spiritual conflict with the hidden power. And this is the origin of all your, by the way, your conspiracy theory, if you get down to it. The real hidden power in Persia is an Archon. The real hidden power in Greece is an archon. And these archons are related to the survival of the spirits of the watchers. So they've sort of got into these non-Jahve worshipping cultures, and that's why they're oppressing the true children of Seth. And the Gnostics pick up on this and then create an entire cosmology based on the idea of the archons not only corrupting the world, but having fashioned it in the first place.
Right, right. Yeah. And so what I'm going to say is, because I know we're pretty much out of time, is recommendation of your book. It is an amazing work of scholarship, and there's so much in there. And I'm grateful that you wrote it. My knowledge of the Book of Enoch has radically expanded. I would never again just sweep it away as mere pseudepigrapha to interested students. But like I said, there's a lot we didn't cover in terms of Kabbalah, Metatron.
It's in the book for those who want it.
Yeah, Hermeticism and all of that. So let me ask you the final questions. What are you working on next?
Right. I've just finished and gone off a book on heaven.
Oh, okay.
So the current working title seems to be the super celestial realms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about it's a complete, yeah, a history, a sort of global history of heaven. This is we're still arguing with the publisher about the title, but basically I wanted to call it Heaven, the History, which I'm happy with. The idea was I wanted to show every idea that had been of heaven in every culture from Neolithic ancient times to all the literate cultures. Right, I'm talking Japan, China, Africa, South America, Inuit, Central America, Finland, Siberia, Greece, Israel, obviously, the whole thing, all through, and the develop, and you see, I just thought, well, a lot of people are thinking about the future in the profound sense. We're all threatened by lunatics of one kind or another. And of course, we all have losses of our own and maybe facing our own personal demise. Many people are thinking about heaven all the time. And there's never been a book that covers the whole thing. So it's objective insofar as it's not trying to persuade you. It isn't just a record of people's near-death experiences or what happened to me on the operating table, although that comes into it. Allan Kardec and the origin of what they call spiritualism or spiritism. Some would say a form of necromancy, but often unkind. But all of that, but all these ideas of heaven in one place, in a handy form, I thought would be a great help to people to work out the ultimate destiny of humanity. And, you know, when John Lennon sang, I should say, in his song, Imagine There's No Heaven, my point is that that's not difficult. It's much more difficult in present circumstances for thinking people to imagine there is one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, so let's look at what people have imagined or believed it to be. And let's see how these beliefs compare. And so you have this pan-historical and pan-geographical and pan-cultural perspective. I believe it's the first time this has been done systematically. So it could be my ultimate book. Yeah. You know, Enoch was shown that those heavens. I'm pleased with the book because it is a clear thing. You make your own conclusions and your own thoughts of it. So that'll be out early next year.
Okay.
Other than that, I'm interested at the moment in the whole relationship between magic and the Bible, which was the first thing I wanted to study when I was a student, and they wouldn't let me. So I thought maybe now Maybe I could show them what they miss.
Yeah, I understand that idea of having interests that the advisors are like, no, you need to find something else. So I will look forward to the book on heaven. Hopefully we can speak again when that comes out.
I hope
Let
so.
me, where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, I have a modest website, tobiaschurton.com, which has a list of all my books, what I've done in life, and also sections on my music and musical albums, and some information about the films I've been involved with and made. And there is a whole load of what are they, a podcast things that are accessible, and reviews and so forth. I've just finished my 29th commissioned book, and these are not slight works.
No, they're not. No, they are
My
not.
dad used to talk about, come on, Toby, when I was young, you must write your magnum opus. And I always thought I'd write one book. I never,
Wow.
ever, ever imagined I'd be writing now nearly 30 on subjects that are of great interest to me and to those with the light on.
Yeah. Well, I am grateful that you have written so many books. I've only read a handful of them, but I've always found them very informative and enlightening. So I will put
Thank
a
you.
link to your website and this current book in the show notes in the video description. And thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated it and very much appreciated the conversation.
Oh, it's been really enjoyable, Nick, to speak to somebody who knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, a little bit. That was a great book. I mean, it covers so much, and it's, I think, a really important addition to the scholarship.
Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap on episode 197 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I'm nearing 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 12 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe. It is totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I put a lot of effort and time into each episode. So if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscribers and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship. And honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also buy a super thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to spread the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.